This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made a new effort Wednesday to reach agreement on a long-stalled coronavirus relief package before Congress adjourns so lawmakers can campaign ahead of the November 3rd presidential election. The two discussed details of the aid plan that could send more money to American families and businesses, restore unemployment aid to millions of unemployed workers laid off because of the coronavirus pandemic, provide unemployment aid to millions of unemployed workers laid off because of the coronavirus pandemic, and assistance to state and local governments and offer liability protection to businesses. The sticking point in the discussions is the extent of the aid. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called Wednesday for an immediate infusion of $15 billion to a global pool for the procurement and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines at a virtual summit hosted by the World Body. The ACT Accelerator, led by the World Health Organization, has received around $3 billion of the $38 billion needed to meet the goal of producing and delivering 2 billion vaccine doses, millions in treatments and diagnostic tests over the next year. Notable new pledges include additional funding from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And Britain's Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said his country could add more money in matching funds. Sweden's Prime Minister Stefan Löfven pledged some more money, while Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau touted a $332 million commitment made last week, half of which will go to lower-income countries. There are approximately 1,013,000 COVID-19-related deaths globally, with nearly 34 million confirmed infections. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Australia's coronavirus hotspot state, Victoria, reported its 800th death from the virus Thursday, but low case numbers raised the prospect of a COVID normal 2021 without lockdown or social restrictions. Victoria's state premier Daniel Andrews told reporters in Melbourne that we're confident we're able to build a COVID normal Christmas, a COVID normal summer, and a virus at such a low level that we can sustain that over the long term. Victoria, the country's second most populous state, accounts for 90% of national COVID-19 deaths. Australia, with 888 fatalities, has fared far better than many other developed countries. A U.S. court has approved an $800 million settlement for victims of the United States' worst mass shooting, a rampage that left 58 dead and more than 800 wounded in Las Vegas, and the October 2017 massacre. A man opened fire with rifles from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, unleashing more than 1,000 rounds as he mowed down people among a crowd attending an outdoor country music festival. MGM Resorts International, the casino's owner, will pay $49 million of its own funds, while the remainder is to come from its insurers. An earlier statement said the settlement does not amount to an admission of liability by MGM Resorts. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam Thursday described foreign sanctions imposed against Hong Kong government officials as brutal, while defending the need to continue implementing a contentious national security law in the Chinese financial capital. Lam spoke at a reception that followed a morning flag-raising ceremony marking the 71st anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. The ceremony came as anti-government protests have dwindled due to the coronavirus restrictions on group gatherings and fears over a sweeping national security law imposed by Beijing on June 30th. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro Wednesday pledged to improve gasoline output and distribution in the fuel-starved nation, as the second of three Iranian tankers carrying fuel entered the South American country's waters. The once prosperous OPEC nation is struggling under a collapsing oil industry and U.S. sanctions that have crippled imports and exports, resulting in snaking lines of drivers waiting for gasoline at state-run oil company. And as part of the new plan, which Maduro said would be detailed in the coming days, Venezuelans would be limited to filling their tanks on certain days depending on their license plate numbers. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate, Washington. Today is Thursday, October 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission summons a former president.
This is not about SFPP. This is not about APC. This is not about any other political party, NGC, what you may have. It's about the battle for the soul of Sierra Leone, for the future of our children and our grandchildren.
We'll get reaction from former President Ernest Bai Koroma's lead attorney. A new report says the actions of Guinean President Alpha Conde are impeding free speech ahead of the election. Sudanese women keep pushing for democracy. And a French court agrees to extradite alleged Rwanda genocide financier to a UN court in Arusha, Tanzania.
He's the mastermind of the genocide machine which created the Interahamwe militias, the media of genocide, and imported more than 780 tons of machete.
And concerns in Nigeria over a measure to punish rapists with castration. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission Wednesday summoned the country's immediate past president, Ernest Bai Koroma, to answer questions on Monday about alleged corruption while he was in office. Koroma served two terms from 2007 to 2018. A court earlier this week ordered the former president and 111 former officials from leaving the country. A corruption inquiry report released last week ordered Koroma and some of his former officials to forfeit assets totaling $200 million. Francis Ben Kaifala, chief of the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission, says the fight against corruption is for the soul and the future of Sierra Leone.
There are certain things that have to do with certain suspicious transactions which benefited him. That's one. For example, the issue surrounding a Chinese-named company that about $6 million was channeled through and which we have evidence somehow benefited him. We also have other issues surrounding investigation. We are also investigating issues of unexplained wealth. And there are many. Basically, all of them center around corruption. And we believe that it is good, even for his own interest, it is good for him to make clarifications on them, for him to provide evidence on them, for him to be actually confronted with some of them so we can have his perspective.
I read the article and it says that the former president Koroma's property in Makeni is among assets worth $200 million that the Madabio government has ordered Mr. Koroma or his officials to forfeit. What exactly is the problem with the Makeni property?
As you know, a public officer has to live within his income, and that includes your declared income at the time you took up office and what you had at the time you left office. So those properties, basically, according to the Commissions of Inquiry, there is a clear calculation of what was President Koroma's actual earnings during the period of his presidency. And they are basically saying that since he built those properties at the time when he was president, that those properties were not commensurate to his income because his entire income is about 4 billion leones. But just one of the properties is, even the small one in Freetown, is estimated, according to the Commissions of Inquiry conclusions, it's estimated at about 40 billion leones. And that even is not, if you look at the Makeni property, which is built on a 25-acre land with a double-walled fence and other things, I think those are really highly valuable properties. And that is why, apart from what the Commissions of Inquiry says, which are going to be enforced by the Office of the Attorney General, we basically need to ask him questions.
The former president, the ruling party, the All People's Congress Party, has said in the past that these allegations are politically motivated and they are intended to tarnish the reputation of the former president.
Yes, I mean, I've seen a press release which he has put out, even following our invitation, where he's saying that. But I can assure you what we are doing has nothing to do with politics. It has nothing to do with witch hunt. It has everything to do with the actual raw evidence that we have, with the actual facts that we have. I am sure after he comes and we interview him on some of these issues, he will leave a happier man because it is good for him himself to know the things that are against him, for him to be able to provide evidence against him.
Again, I keep saying, what kind of message is your commission trying to send if you are summoning a former president?
Well, we are trying to send a clear message for public servants that the fight against corruption is not going to leave a stone unturned. This is not about APC. This is not about any other political party, NGC, what you may have. It's about a battle for the soul of Sierra Leone, for the future of our children and our grandchildren.
Francis Ben Kaifala is chief of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Former Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma says he is utterly dismayed by the current government's hostility towards him and some of his former officials. Koroma, who served two consecutive terms from 2007 to 2018, was reacting to a commission of inquiry report about alleged corrupt practices during his tenure. He said the allegations are politically motivated and intended to impugn his reputation. The statement issued yesterday, Wednesday, followed a summons by the Anti-Corruption Commission for the former president to answer questions about alleged corruption during his administration. Joseph Kamara is the lead counsel for former President Koroma.
Well, notice has been sent to the office of the former president, and we acknowledge receipt of it, and it is being reviewed. The former president is deeply disappointed with the contents of the report of the commissions of inquiry and the white paper. As the president, he is dismayed with the hostility that the government has displayed towards his name, integrity, and his reputation.
One of the allegations being made by the Anti-Corruption Commission is that the president's property in McKinney is among at least assets worth $200 million that the Madabio government has ordered Mr. Koroma or his officials to forfeit. What do you make of these allegations?
Like I said, we are reviewing the summons. I've not seen it myself. We want to know what are the contents, because for now there is a judgment and he is appealing the judgment. We as his lawyers are working on his appeal. So we are quite astounded as to why summon him again on the same issues. So we will review the summons and see if there are new issues. If there are no new issues, then we will advise ourselves accordingly. We can only say that these allegations are baseless and unfounded. We were at the commissions of inquiry. None of these allegations have been established with an iota of evidence. So we are disappointed, surprised, and believe that it's a clear witch hunt, and it is targeted to ruin his image and make him destitute in his sense of property.
He has said before that these allegations are intended to just smear the character of the of his administration. Does he still feel that way?
Most certainly. He believes that and feels that way, because the impugning of his character is not limited to him himself, but even the good people that have served his administration. For 10 years under his administration, there's been peace, cohesion, and growth in the country. But today we see otherwise. So most certainly he's very aggrieved, tormented, and surprised that all his good work will be brought into disrepute.
Is the former president still in Sierra Leone, or is he out of the country?
He's very much in Sierra Leone. It's his quiet hometown of McKinney. He's keeping his peace and providing the necessary support to all the people that are around him and those that he can help with.
Thank you very much, Eno, for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. You're welcome anytime.
Joseph Kamara is the former Attorney General of Sierra Leone and lead counsel for former President Ernest Bai Koroma. He was speaking with us from the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown. Amnesty International says action by Guinean President Alpha Conde and his ruling party ahead of October 18 presidential elections are impeding freedom of speech and even inciting violence. This was contained in a new report released today, Thursday. Amnesty International researcher Fabian Offner tells Breaking Stryer that while the ruling party is allowed to do anything it wants in terms of demonstrations, opposition parties are subject to arrest if they demonstrate.
Yeah, the current atmosphere is quite worrying, and unfortunately the path leading to this election is particularly scandalous in terms of human rights in particular. In the last month, we've seen a change in the constitution, and this change has led to demonstrations that were most of the time forbidden. And we also saw that dozens of people were killed, allegedly by defense and security forces, and that almost nothing has been done to bring justice to the families and to the victims. And now the election approaching, we see what is going on with violation of the right of freedom of assembly, people being arrested and jailed. So, of course, there are a lot of concerns, and we see that the atmosphere is even getting worse and worse the more we come to the election. And one point which is also particularly worrying, it's the, all these dangerous speeches that have been said mostly by the authorities.
What have the authorities, especially President Alpha Conde, been saying about these demonstrations, especially given the fact that Alpha Conde's role as running again is quite contentious, given that he had to change the constitution to do so?
What we've seen in the last month is many times the FNDC was not allowed to demonstrate officially because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But what we've seen since the beginning of the campaign is that the supporters of the ruling party, the RPG, were allowed to organize meetings, and quite huge meetings. So we can see that it's different thing depending on who wants to demonstrate. The FNDC was not allowed to demonstrate because of the COVID, and not the supporters of the ruling party are allowed to do so. And what we've seen yesterday also, a demonstration of the FNDC was also forbidden, and for other reasons, which doesn't really fit with the international standard and laws.
Guinea announced in late September the border closures between Senegal and Guinea-Bissau. What was the reason given, and are there human rights concerns about this border closure, given the timing of it ahead of elections?
Yeah, the thing is, there has not been any official announcement about the border of the closures. But Alpha Condé and one main government official said that the border was closed because some official in Sierra Leone would have met some other people to possibly organize a plot against Guinea. This is hardly understandable to think about this if it's not within the context of the election. This kind of decision, unfortunately, will make this poll even more dangerous, with these rumors that could lead to some violences between people, as we saw it in 2010.
That was Fabien Offner, a researcher at Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 1st. A top French appeals court has refused to block the extradition of alleged financier of Rwanda's 1994 genocide to a United Nations tribunal. As Lisa Bryant reports from Paris, France now has a month to extradite 84-year-old Felicien Kabuga to the court in Tanzania.
The decision by France's Court of Cassation is a blow to Felicien Kabuga, who was arrested at his Paris-area apartment in May after a quarter century on the run. Kabuga's lawyers had appealed an earlier ruling that he should stand trial at a UN court based in Arusha, Tanzania. They said his health was poor and raised fears the UN court would be biased against him. But the Court of Cassation said it saw no legal or medical obstacle to Kabuga's transfer to Arusha.
La réaction de Kabuga France est une grande satisfaction que il puisse enfin.
Etienne Nzanzimana, president of Rwandan Genocide Survivors Support Group Kabuga France, hailed the ruling. Now he said it was time international justice played its role and end the years of impunity Kabuga had enjoyed. Once one of Rwanda's richest men, Kabuga is accused of bankrolling militia groups responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus. He reportedly founded and was heavily involved in Radio-Television Midi-Colline, whose incendiary broadcast fanned ethnic hatred. More than two decades ago, Kabuga was indicted by the UN Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, or ICTR, on seven counts, including genocide. He denies all the charges as lies. Kabuga is to be tried at the Mechanism for International Criminal Tribunals, which took over from the ICTR after it closed in 2013. Rwanda said it wanted to have him tried in its own courts. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In Rwanda, the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide says it welcomes the decision by a French appeals court to extradite alleged genocide perpetrator Félicien Kabuga to the United Nations-run tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania. Kabuga is accused of masterminding the 1994 genocide against the Tutsis. French authorities arrested Kabuga in May this year. Bedire Diogene is the principal advisor for the commission. He says the French appeals court decision sends a strong message to the fight against impunity because Kabuga played a major role in the effort to exterminate the Tutsis.
The reaction of the Rwanda National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide is a normal decision. Everyone is delighted with the decision of the French Court of Cassation, which today rejected the appeal urged by Kabuga against the decision of his transfer to the mechanism which continues the activities of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. We recall that Kabuga is the main financier of the genocide, whether for the distribution of machete and for the financing of the genocide media, especially the radio of Thousand Hills, Radio de Milcolin. If Kabuga had not been in charge, if he has not been the mastermind of genocide, we think that lives would have been saved.
Would you have loved for Kabuga to be tried in Rwanda rather than the International Tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania?
Judging a genocide fugitive in Rwanda or elsewhere is always good news. The important thing is that those who planned and carried out the genocide are arrested and charged in Rwanda or elsewhere. The arrest of Kabuga in France and the decision taken by the French court is very encouraging.
Diogene, can you describe for us the role that Kabuga allegedly played in the Rwanda genocide?
Kabuga is one of the planners of the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi in 1994 in Rwanda. Kabuga is born in 1935 as one of the most genocide fugitive under international investigation. He's the mastermind of the genocide machine which created the Interahamwe militias, the media of genocide like Radio de Milcolin, and imported more than 780 tons of machete, which were used during genocide to kill innocent people. And he's at the head of the creation of the National Defense Fund, a criminal organization to continue the genocide. Kabuga was on the run for 26 years.
Bedire Diogene is the principal advisor for the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide in Rwanda. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. Sudanese women played a key role in the 2019 removal of former President Omar al-Bashir from power. As Sudan's transitional government moves towards democracy, for the first time in decades, women are playing a key role in seeking justice and equality. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese women helped organize the protest that resulted in the oust of former President Omar al-Bashir in 2019, after 3 decades of iron-fisted rule. After his removal and the creation of a new transitional government, women are playing a prominent role in Sudan's politics. A woman has been appointed the Chief Justice, the first not only in Sudan but in the entire Arab world. An unprecedented 4 women were appointed to cabinet positions in the new government, including the country's first female Minister of Foreign Affairs, Asma Muhammad Abdullah. But women are still marching to amend the laws and restore the rights taken from them under the strict Islamic code enforced by Bashir's government. The Sudanese Professionals Association, or SPA, was one of the key groups behind the demonstrations that led to Bashir's ouster. Samahir al-Mubarak, who heads the SPA's Pharmacists Association, remains active in politics. And Mubarak says she has never felt that they have reached a level where they should stop. She says the motivation that powered people to overthrow the Bashir regime is the same motivation that is pushing people to continue to reach the revolution's goals of freedom, peace, and justice. The June 3, 2019 crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in Khartoum left more than 120 people dead, including the eldest son of Amir Qaboos. Her son's death didn't deter Qaboos from being involved in the democratic movement, and she's now the deputy chief of an organization of people who lost relatives in the uprising. Sitting beside a portrait of her late son in her house in Khartoum, Qaboos is insistent. She says what they are doing is the continuous of the martyrs' rule and their sacrifices. But they have not reached their goals yet. She says they haven't seen the freedom, peace and justice the martyrs demanded, and they will continue until they achieve all of the revolution's goals that their children sacrificed for, and to restore their rights until they see Sudan the way their children dreamt about, and they all are dreaming about, she adds. Qaboos and al-Mubarak were recently awarded the 2020 Freedom House Award for their role in advancing democratic change in Sudan. The award was given under the theme, The Power of Protest. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Nigerian lawmakers in the northwestern state of Kaduna have approved a measure to castrate men convicted of raping children under the age of 14. The controversial law comes in the wake of public outrage over the rising number of rape cases in recent months. But while supporters praise the new law as a move to defend women and children, some human rights activists say it is too harsh and may even fail to deter perpetrators. Timothy Obiezu has more from Kaduna State.
It's a typical lonely day for 13-year-old Amina, which is not her real name, in a safe house located in Rigasa area of Kaduna State. She was brought here 1 month ago after being raped by three men from her neighborhood. She feeds her pet cat as she recounts her ordeal. I was hanging around the shops. I didn't want to go inside the house because my stepmom was beating me. They called me and gave me a drink and then raped me, she says. Amina is not the only girl being held here. Her roommate, also a teenage girl, said she had been molested by her own father. Amina says she's even more upset because her father, a police officer, dismissed the case after being bribed by her attackers. I feel bad that my dad did that, she says. But Amina's case has been reopened with help from Samira Madibu, a Kaduna-based activist who is one of the coordinators of a state-led campaign against rape. The three men have been rearrested and are awaiting judgment. They could be among the first to be surgically castrated under a new law punishing rapists of children under the age of 14, says Madibu.
Anyone that could rape a child does not deserve to live. And I actually stand by that because it takes a monster to be able to. There are a lot of things that come with sexual violation of kids. It's not just about the emotional damages. There are physical damages and sometimes for the rest of their lives.
Nigeria's federal law provides between 14 years and life imprisonment as punishment for rape. But states can set different sanctions. Human rights lawyer Okoro Kelechi argues the new law is too harsh and may fail to address the issue.
I don't think surgical castration, for me, addresses the root problem of rape, because rape occurs more in the mind than in the act. Okay, I like to look at it as something that is more psychological. It goes beyond the sex. So it's not about the utensil or the tool used to achieve sexual pleasure.
Local aid agencies in Kaduna say over 400 cases of rape were reported in the state during the coronavirus lockdown. No one knows whether many more states in Nigeria will adopt this new law, but activists like Modibo say they will remain vigilant to ensure children are protected and offenders are held accountable. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Kaduna, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.